Hello from the Financial Times in London. I'm Andreas Parlite, and this is News in Focus, where we offer our insights into the stories that matter. Hundreds of thousands of Hong Kong people have been caught up in a pro-democracy movement that has plunged the former British colony into its worst political crisis in decades. While their protests are directed ostensibly against Hong Kong's government, everyone knows that their real foe is China, a rising superpower with the world's largest army and a furious leadership that has likened the insurrection to terrorism. Su Lin Wong spent several months with the protesters to find out what motivates them and to try to gauge what happens next. And she's on the line with me now to discuss what she discovered. Su Lin, you spent months with these people. How would you characterise a typical Hong Kong protester?
Well, in June, we saw more than a quarter of the city's population take to the streets in protest. So it's quite difficult to define what the typical Hong Kong protester is, since the protests initially at least had such widespread appeal. Of course, since June, we've seen the movement evolve away from just being about a controversial extradition bill and into calls for genuine universal suffrage. Surveys have been done which show most protesters are young, between the ages of 20 and 30, and the majority have graduated from university. The main character I followed for 8 weeks reporting out the magazine piece is a frontline protester who goes by the name Nick Wu. And he got his start with political activism a while ago in 2012, opposing a national education curriculum that the Hong Kong government wanted to introduce that would teach, for example, that Chinese Communist Party rule was quote unquote superior to Western style democracy. And then he was involved with the Umbrella Movement in 2014, where we saw 79 days of mostly peaceful protests in central Hong Kong that ended in failure. And I think all of this political activism led to where he is today, which is feeling very, very frustrated and angry about the future of Hong Kong and feeling disenfranchised as a young person. In some ways, that is very emblematic of what a lot of the young people out protesting in Hong Kong right now feel.
Okay, where do you think the yearning for democratic freedoms in Hong Kong stems from? Is it a frustration over economic inequalities, or does it stem from the territory's history as a former British colony?
So I think there are a combination of factors for this yearning for democracy. But again, it mostly stems from this deep sense of anger at a very, very broken political system in Hong Kong, where the government is often only responsive to the Chinese Communist Party and to the tycoons and very, very wealthy people. So I think there's a feeling amongst protesters that without genuine universal suffrage, it will be very hard to fix the slew of problems facing Hong Kong, including, for example, the world's most expensive property prices, as well as growing social inequality.
I was in Hong Kong during the 2014 Umbrella Revolution, and it was characterised by its order and peacefulness. What do you think today's protesters have learnt from that movement's failure?
I think today's protesters have learnt a lot from the failure of the Umbrella Movement. And most importantly, I think they've learnt to quote unquote be water, a famous quote from Bruce Lee, which is about being adaptable and fluid to rapidly changing circumstances. So, for example, during the Umbrella Movement, a lot of the protesters slept on the main arteries of central Hong Kong. Whereas now the protesters go home every night and they tell me they do that so they can get a good night's sleep and rest and prepare for the next protest. And that is one of the reasons we've seen this round of unrest last for longer than the Umbrella Movement. Another big difference is that this movement is largely leaderless because so many of the leaders of Umbrella were put into jail. And there's also a lot more solidarity this time around between the more moderate, peaceful protesters and the more radical frontliners. And that is also a big difference between Umbrella and now. We are seeing escalating violence in Hong Kong, and we are seeing the frontline protesters turn to much more radical means than during the Umbrella Movement. And surprisingly, there hasn't been that much of a split yet between the moderates and the radicals, which is very possibly because of this deep sense of frustration, anger at the system, and this feeling that peaceful protests don't work anymore. So when the protesters stormed Hong Kong's Legislative Council on July 1st, there was a graffiti message left that said, you taught us peaceful protests don't work. And that was a reference to Carrie Lam, the chief executive, who had said she was withdrawing or suspending the extradition bill, not because of peaceful protests, but because of violent protests that erupted afterwards.
You describe how a documentary about one protester, Edward Leung, has been a source of inspiration for many of the protesters. Can you tell us his story?
Yeah, Edward Leung is an activist who was disqualified from running for Hong Kong's most recent Legislative Council elections because of his pro-independence views. And he's currently serving a 6-year prison sentence for his role in clashes between protesters and police in 2016, which became known as the Fishbowl Revolution, and is what many of the frontline protesters I've interviewed say was the start of Hong Kong's localism movement, which is a push for greater autonomy or even self-determination and independence. And as a result of all this, he has become the face of Hong Kong's independence movement, as well as the closest figure that the frontline protesters have right now to a spiritual guide in this largely leaderless movement. So, for example, the slogan of the protests, Liberate Hong Kong, Revolution of Our Times, was coined by him. And many of the protesters I spoke to told me that the documentary made about his life has been hugely influential on them and their political views.
There's also a kind of anthem popularised on YouTube by an orchestra dressed in gas masks and hard hats that has been watched nearly 3 million times. How effective has that been in spreading the message of those who want a more independent future?
There have been so many extraordinary things that have happened over the past few months in Hong Kong, and I would say that the rise of this anthem is one of the most extraordinary. So you'll see people singing it solemnly with their hands on their hearts at football matches and in shopping malls and on the streets at protests. Nick, the main character of my piece, told me that it was only after this song came out that he finally understood why some people can get so emotional about their national anthem. I think the anthem means different things to different people, and more moderate protesters tell me they don't see it as a song about independence, but I guess that's the power of music. It really is open to interpretation, and there are some people who see it as the national anthem they never had.
What's the anthem's title and who wrote it?
The anthem is called Glory to Hong Kong, and it was composed by someone under a pseudonym. And what is really interesting about it is that towards the end of the composition process, the person put the lyrics on LAHKG, which is a very popular online forum used by the protesters to organise, and he crowdsourced the lyrics. He sort of asked people for feedback about the lyrics. So it really feels like a song of the people. And we've seen multiple versions spring up on YouTube, including the most famous one, which has almost 3 million views.
Is there a generation gap between older people and the mainly youthful demonstrators? How united is the population of Hong Kong behind the protesters' goals, if not the methods?
So never before in Hong Kong's history have we seen a protest movement that has had such widespread support across different social identities and different professional groups. I've spoken to doctors and nurses and lawyers and programmers, construction workers who are all using their skills to try to contribute to the movement. And one of the characters I interviewed for the piece is a barrister, and she's part of a group of progressive lawyers who fight to uphold democracy and the rule of law in Hong Kong. But I was really surprised. It wasn't something I set out to uncover, but in the course of my reporting, almost every protester I interviewed, whether they were radical or moderate, told me about the clashes that they had with their parents and how many of their parents thought that the protesters were unreasonable, that they were trying to destroy Hong Kong, that they should just keep their heads down and focus on their careers and on making money, and that fighting for democracy was far too lofty a goal. I mean, I think Another big difference between the older and younger generations is that the older generation is more likely to have stronger ties to mainland China. So they might have been born there or raised there and left because of poverty and because of the upheaval of the 60s and 70s. Their lives in Hong Kong were much more stable and it provided them with a path out of poverty. Whereas for the younger generation, they see the freedoms their parents really appreciated in Hong Kong being eroded, and they're also seeing this growing social inequality. So there is a generational divide in that sense. But there was some polling done on how widespread the support is amongst Hong Kong society for the current protests, particularly as we're seeing the violence escalate. And a newspaper in Hong Kong, which is considered relatively neutral, Ming Pao, found that, interestingly, public sympathy with the protesters actually grew despite the protesters' violence. The people polled who agree that radical protest action is justified has actually increased to almost 60%.
The Hong Kong government seems to have misjudged the situation every step of the way. How do you explain that lack of sensitivity towards what is obviously a very popular movement?
I think it's very clear that the Hong Kong government is not used to governing a society where the government has to be responsive to the will of the people. I mean, it's utterly remarkable that not a single person in the current government has stepped down because of the worst political crisis that we've seen in Hong Kong in decades. And I think on top of that, Carrie Lam, who has the worst approval ratings of any chief executive in the history of Hong Kong, clearly doesn't listen and isn't responsive to what people want. I mean, 1 million people took to the streets in early June. Subsequently, 2 million people took to the streets in peaceful protest. And she didn't respond to what they were asking for, which was withdrawing the extradition bill. Only 3 months later did she respond.
How realistic are the protesters about their chances of success?
A lot of the protesters I interviewed said to me they're pretty gloomy about their chances of success. And one of the slogans I kept hearing was, "If we burn, you burn with us," which is from The Hunger Games, which is dystopian teenage fiction where young people embark on often suicidal missions against an authoritarian government.
Do they imagine that there will be more fights or that they'll be crushed?
Nick, the frontline protester I followed, told me towards the end of my reporting that he felt that the frontline protesters were being arrested at a rate faster than the backline protesters could replace them. So because of all the arrests, there's a fear amongst the frontline protesters that the protests might simmer out. That isn't what we're seeing right now on the ground. But Hong Kong has a very long history of protests, each larger than the previous one. So even if we see this round of unrest fizzle out, it's very likely that the underlying social problems and this deep desire amongst many Hong Kongers for democracy is not going to go away and will erupt the next time there is some kind of trigger. One thing that was really powerful that Nick told me was, if we fail this time, they will have another fight. And he actually said he thinks that the direction the protests are heading in is civil war.
This is obviously a major crisis for Hong Kong, but what's at stake for China?
To China, Hong Kong is an international financial hub and a gateway connecting China and the world. And obviously the recent protests have really rocked the Hong Kong economy, and we've seen business confidence plummet, we've seen tourist arrivals drop, retail sales have really been hit. So from an economic perspective, this international financial hub has really been impacted by the protests. But I think more than that, what's at stake for China is an existential question. It's very likely that Beijing has lost several generations of hearts and minds in Hong Kong, and the implications of that are really quite enormous. I think another element that has attracted a lot of interest, particularly internationally, is the troops that are massing on the border of Hong Kong in Shenzhen. And there was speculation a couple of months ago that Beijing might send troops across the border into Hong Kong to squash the unrest there. But we haven't seen that happen. And a lot of analysts say it's highly unlikely that that is what Beijing will do, just because that would obviously create a new crisis in relations between China and the rest of the world.
And what level of awareness among normal Chinese people across the border is there of Hong Kong's protests, and what level, if any, of sympathy?
When the protests first broke out, a lot of the news about Hong Kong was censored. But now that we've seen more than 4 months of unrest, Beijing's propaganda machine has kicked into play and people are aware of what is happening across the border. Anecdotally, the people I speak to are not particularly sympathetic to Hong Kong. I think that is partially because the propaganda has been reasonably effective. The Chinese Communist Party has really gone all out with their messaging, not just through traditional party organs like the People's Daily Newspaper, but also online and on Chinese social media, and have likened the demonstrations to terrorism. And they call the protesters things like radical thugs and traitors towards China.
Finally, Su Lin, what's your view about the future of Hong Kong? Is it doomed to submit to authoritarian rule from China? Or will the protests eventually force China itself to change?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, I guess, that everyone is asking. It's very, very difficult to predict what is going to happen even next week, let alone next year. But the trajectory that China is on is one where we've seen Chinese President Xi Jinping really clamp down across the political spectrum, and it's unlikely that that is going to reverse in the near term. We've also seen Beijing come down very hard on companies and organizations that have been seen to be sympathetic to the protesters. For example, Cathay Pacific, as well as the NBA, and we're likely to see more companies caught in the crossfire. One thing that I heard in the course of my reporting was this growing concern about Hong Kong's population policy. 150 mainlanders are granted residency every day in Hong Kong, and a lot of the Hong Kong protesters told me that was a policy they really opposed because they fear that in a couple of decades, the Chinese government will have used this population policy to really try to integrate Hong Kong into the mainland. But one of the people I spoke to for my piece, Samantha, who came from mainland China to Hong Kong, told me she came to Hong Kong because she wanted the freedoms granted to people in Hong Kong that are not granted to people in the mainland. And she actually said if she had been born and raised in Hong Kong, she would be on the streets protesting. So we obviously see a very, very wide range of political views from mainland Chinese in Hong Kong. And that also might influence the future of the city.
Thanks, Su Lin, and thanks for listening. And if you'd like to read Su Lin's magazine article, you can find a link in our show notes. We've launched a new podcast this month called The Rackman Review, a weekly look at global affairs by the FT's chief foreign affairs commentator, Gideon Rackman. This week's show looks at US policy towards China, and we hear from the person widely regarded as the chief architect of this policy, Nadia Shadlow. This show is exclusively for FT subscribers. So if that's you, please go to ft.com/Rackman Review and sign up for a taste of the global political debates that Gideon writes about in his columns.